Our last case this morning is 2020-1392, the State of Ohio versus John D. Yerke. For the state, Ms. Jones.
Thank you and good morning, Chief Justice O'Connor. May it please the court. My name is Tammy Riley Jones. I'm here on behalf of the state today, and I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. Your Honors, this case presents a question with regard to the entitlement of victims to lost wages incurred during their active participation in the prosecution of a case as part of a restitution order. Under Article 1, Section 10A of the Ohio Constitution, commonly referred to as Marcy's Law, victims have been granted a constitutional right to full and timely restitution. And it is the state's suggestion that the full and timely restitution must include lost wages incurred as a result of active participation in the prosecution of the offense.
And, Counselor, are you specifically making it that narrow active participation? So if a victim or an alleged victim of a crime simply attends the hearings, is that person excluded?
No, Your Honors. I believe that attendance at the hearings would be part of that active participation, because by attending the hearings, the victims then have the opportunity to exercise their other constitutionally guaranteed rights under Marcy's Law, which would include not only just being present, but participating in or perhaps voicing their opinions or objections as set forth in the other provisions of Marcy's Law.
They could, but if they don't, you're saying their presence there alone is still active participation.
Yes, Your Honor. Okay. That would be the position that I'd be advancing.
Okay.
That Marcy's Law grants that constitutional right to full and timely restitution, and that constitutional right is paramount to any legislative or statutory designations with regard to restitution.
Counsel, would restitution be limited to lost wages connected to the prosecution, or could it include mileage to the court, gasoline, child care services while they attend meetings? Would that be included in restitution?
Your Honor, because Marcy's Law indicates that a victim is entitled to full and timely restitution, I think we need to look to the meaning of the term full. Full meaning complete, and restitution being designed, of course, to restore a victim to their position prior to the to being thrust into the criminal justice system, if you will, by virtue of the defendant's conduct or criminal conduct. I think there could be an argument made that that other type of claim would indeed fit within the intent of the legislature to provide full and complete restitution. I don't think that that even is that contrary to the statutory framework even in existence today in the determination of a court about economic loss reflecting any economic detriment to a victim as a result of the commission of a crime. I think that part of the error in the Seventh District's holding here is that in looking at the statutory framework, not only did they disregard the more expansive rights granted under Marcy's Law to full and timely restitution, but that they narrowly interpreted the statutory definition of economic loss set forth in 2929.01L. And in saying that, I reference the language of that provision that says that economic loss means any economic detriment suffered as a direct and proximate result of the commission of the offense, and then goes on to provide what I would say were some illustrative examples. But the Seventh District appeared to interpret that as an exhaustive list. And if the income loss didn't...
Well, I think that they characterized it or limited it to the commission of the offense, not the consequence of the prosecution. But my question here is, does this elevate people who are, you know, exercising their rights under Marcy's Law from other victims that are in other categories?
I'm not sure I understand your question, Your Honor.
Well, does Marcy's Law cover all victims?
Thank you. Marcy's Law does apply to victims as victims is defined within Marcy's Law, and this court has addressed the meaning of the term victim in the decision of the City of Centerville versus NAB, and in so doing, analyzed the definition of victim to determine who was a victim by looking to the plain language of the constitutional amendment. In the Centerville decision, this court determined that a municipality would not constitute a victim entitled to restitution under Marcy's Law, but rather looked to the plain language and determined that persons, natural persons, affected by the against whom the crime was committed or those that were proximately harmed by the commission of the offense would constitute victims of the offense. And I don't know if that answers your Honor's question.
So, again, this all refers to the commission, the victims of the commission of the crime, and that's what the appellate court limited itself to, limited the analysis and the decision.
They did, Your Honor, refer to the commission and excluded from that understanding of the commission of the offense the ongoing prosecution of that offense, which of course is a natural and foreseeable consequence when you're committing a criminal offense, that you're going to have a prosecution of that offense. And then the expenses that a victim incurs as a result of that prosecution would be directly related to the commission of the offense.
And how is that collected? What's the theory about how the victim would collect the parking, the gas, the child care, the lost wages? How would that be collected? Is that a judgment against the individual?
No, Your Honor. I believe that an order of restitution, as is set forth in the provisions under 2929.18a, and this court recognized that that provision would be the procedural mechanism for the order of restitution with regard to the holding of a hearing, the designation of the payment and the manner and the terms of the payment. And I don't know that that procedural process conflicts with the constitutional, the paramount constitutional rights under Marcy's Law.
So then that would also apply, for example, to post-conviction hearings that the victim would attend?
Your Honor, I don't know if I would be able to speak to that particular instance. I don't know that in a post-conviction hearing, restitution would be something that the court hearing a post-conviction matter would address. I think restitution
I'm asking you because
would
you're addressed. If the victim is attending, anything post-sentence. Is that included in your analysis?
I apologize, Your Honor. I didn't mean to speak over you.
That's okay.
The understanding about restitution and the right to full and timely restitution relates to restitution resulting from the commission of the offense. The restitution order under the procedural mechanism set forth in 2929.18a is something that the trial court would address at the sentencing phase or the sentencing level.
I'm sorry, if you finish your answer, I didn't want to cut you off.
That's okay.
All right.
Thank you, Justice.
So, from a practical standpoint, how does this work? So the victim comes to crime, let's say a victim of a robbery, comes to the hearings every day. The trial court might allocate 2 hours a day to that case because the trial court's docket is full and might do a bunch of other things. Case might drag on for some days getting expert witnesses in. Trial court judge has to leave early. Just all the things that's not controllable, of course, by the defendant or the victim in the case. There's a conviction. Mm-hmm. And you're saying that all the lost wages from the victim based on that conviction should go into the restitution order. Whatever is deemed appropriate, child care or lost wages or those sort of things, should go into the restitution order at that time, correct?
I would say, Your Honor, that the victim would be entitled to claim as full and timely restitution, the lost wages, et cetera, for that participation and attendance, and present it to the trial court under the mechanism set forth in 2929.18.
Okay, and so let's say the trial court agrees, mm-hmm. and there's that amount set. It goes up on appeal. It's reversed on appeal, maybe, let's say. And let's say it's reversed and remanded for a new trial. Then you go through the same things again. Mm-hmm. And arguably, if the victim came, would be allowed for the same set of expenses, if you will. Would she then get them for the he or she get them for the first and the second?
Your Honor, I believe that the ongoing nature of the case, and if I'm understanding your question correctly, the ongoing nature of the case on a reversal remand and coming back to attend these proceedings would be something that, yes, should be included in a future restitution order, because the victims not only have the right to full and timely restitution, but also have the right, constitutionally guaranteed right, to attend all proceedings in conjunction with that offense, and to be present, to be heard, and to participate. Marcy's Law creates this participatory range of rights for victims, and I don't think those stop if the case ends up on perhaps remand and then has to be retried. I don't believe that those rights to be present, to participate, to attend, et cetera, continue.
What is the defendant's remedy if he's wrongfully convicted and that he is ultimately exonerated as wrongfully convicted?
With regard to the restitution order, right, that would have been imposed as part of the sentence?
Correct.
Your Honor, I would respectfully suggest that that would be handled in the same manner as vacating the sentence and
if there was
vacating that restitution order.
And if there was anything paid to the victim, how is that recovered?
Well, Your Honors, I do believe that the provision, which I would refer to as the procedural mechanism, the statutory provision, does provide that any restitution payments made go against any other types of claims or recoveries, civil actions, et cetera, ordering damages. So perhaps that restitution order that has been paid by the defendant, if paid during the pendency of the case or the appellate process, would then be perhaps applied to any other types of recovery that would have been made. I'm not here to really speak to the defendant's rights to recover that type of restitution if there's a reversal of the conviction, but rather to suggest to the court that in this particular case, the Seventh District improperly looked at the issue of lost wages in this case and making its determination in relying solely on the statutory framework and not giving effect to the constitutional rights that were created by Marcy's Law and are now guaranteed to victims in the course of these types of cases.
Counsel,
yes, sir.
I've looked up a lot of restitution cases. Okay, and I've tried to analogize to torts, mm-hmm. Personal injury or fraud. I can't find one, despite trying to find one, in which the person's participation in court was reimbursed under restitution. I plenty of them for lost wages because they were in the hospital and things like that. I couldn't find one for attendance in court. Is there any? Are there any?
Your Honor, there are a number of cases in which lost wages have had been held to be compensable as restitution
for
criminal
attendance.
Proceedings. I'm sorry?
For attendance at the court?
Yes, lost wages incurred as a result of attending the court proceedings.
Under a subpoena or voluntary?
No distinction with regard to Marcy's Law would be my argument. And in those cases, I think that the courts also held that there would be no distinction with regard to whether it was a voluntary attendance. And I guess I'm referring to some other states
that have held different wording.
That the lost wages were compensable.
Right.
I think that in Ohio, and this did predate Marcy's Law, the case that I would refer the court to, well, there were two. Actually, one came out of the 7th District Court of Appeals, and that was the Belbachar case out of the 7th District in 2009. Now, it looked at the restitution statutory framework for misdemeanors as opposed to felonies, which, of course, we're dealing with felonies here, but that the court there found that the victims lost income for missing work because she had to stay home to repair a door that had been damaged in the course of the thing.
Yeah, I know those.
She missed the work, yeah. And then was compensated for that. The other one that I would look to, Your Honor, or point you to, Your Honor, would be the Shiflett case out of the 4th District, in which the victim's family, the victims in that case were minors, but the family was awarded lost wages, et cetera, as part of the economic loss suffered as a direct and proximate result of the commission of the offense. And I guess, again, Shiflett predated Marcy's Law, but he think that in looking at the statutory framework in existence, found that those lost wages.
Was that for lost wages for attendance at court?
Yes, Your Honor, I believe it
on
was
Shiflett.
For them. Yes.
Okay, thanks.
So another question for you. Keeping in mind that restitution is part of the sentence, yes. Is this going to create a disincentive for a defendant to go to trial?
Thank you, Your Honor. That was raised by the amicus brief presented by the Ohio Public Defender's Office in suggesting that a restitution order then would somehow become a trial tax or disincentive, as the court is asking. And I think that that is completely erroneous in terms of the assertion. Restitution is designed to make the victim whole, and it is currently pre-Marcy's Law, allowed as part of a sentence that a court may impose. I don't believe that a defendant would be swayed with regard to their decision to exercise their constitutional rights simply because a victim was exercising their constitutional rights to be present at all proceedings. And if it's
something that there's a presumption in favor of community control, and there is a real question in that defendant's mind about whether they could prevail at trial, looking at all the questions you've been asked about things that can happen before or after the trial, even a new trial, what's the basis for saying there's not a disincentive?
Your Honor, there would be the same types of considerations, I guess, in terms of exercising the constitutional rights by the defendant with regard to the likelihood of success, as the court has mentioned, or things of that nature, but factoring in the potential for having to make restitution to the victim would not be something, in my mind, that a defendant would consider as a disincentive to asserting their constitutional rights. I know the Ohio Public Defender's amicus brief suggested that while a victim may desire to have their reimbursement for lost wages for attending, that their right would have to give way. And that just flies in the face of Marcy's Law and the very purpose of Marcy's Law, which was to secure for victims enforceable rights that would be protected with the same vigor as the rights afforded to defendants.
Sure, but it's almost a collision of two constitutional provisions or concepts, because the defendant has a lot of constitutional rights that have to be considered, and that is that right to a trial. And if we're stepping on it in any way, even with another citizen-adopted constitutional amendment, how do we resolve that?
I don't believe that a restitution order, Your Honor, would be stepping on the defendant's rights to either proceed to trial or choose to somehow resolve their case short of a trial. A restitution order is a potential penalty. The penalty isn't going to be greater simply because the defendant exercises his constitutional rights.
Sure, it's part of a sentence, though, and I think we all agree with that. And in a defendant determining or making the decision whether or not to go forward to trial or to take a plea, I think the paramount issue on the defendant's mind is getting a lesser sentence, or what's my sentence going to be? And if restitution is part of the sentence, how do we not consider that in determining where you want to go?
Restitution would be part of the permissible financial sanctions to be imposed as part of the sentence, Your Honor. But I don't believe that this court should be dissuaded from giving full force and effect to the constitutional amendment adopted by the people of the state of Ohio, giving to victims the right to full and timely restitution, to be dissuaded from giving force and effect to that by suggesting that right of the victim to full and timely restitution is somehow going to impinge upon a defendant's rights.
Well, and that's the tricky thing, because all of the Constitution is really considered to be the voice of the people. That is the document by which it delegates self-governance to those of us who sit here and elsewhere in state government.
That's correct, Your Honor. But a defendant's, a trial tax kind of terminology really relates to a harsher period of incarceration type sentence. I don't know that it's been found.
You didn't hear that from me. That's in the briefs.
Yes, yes.
I said disincentive.
Yes, Your Honor. And I'm sorry if I didn't mean to suggest otherwise, but I know that the reference in the amicus brief was relating this to potentially a trial tax. That kind of harsher penalty, if you will, has been sort of limited to this point in time to a harsher period of incarceration, perhaps.
Counsel,
as for exercise.
Does it matter whether the victim was salaried or paid by the hour?
Your Honor, I don't believe so. I think the court considering the restitution order would have to ferret out how to calculate that lost wage. In this particular case, the victim did testify that she was a salaried employee and had calculated her lost wages as a salaried employee, and the court accepted that testimony as credible, competent evidence of the amount of her loss.
But if somebody's a salaried employee and they're going to get the same salary, if they get reimbursed for time away, aren't they exceeding being made whole or being gaining above whole?
I would respectfully suggest to the court that if they were a salaried employee who lost time at work, that those issues could be addressed at a restitution hearing at the trial court level.
Well,
yes, Your Honor.
So do we, if we agree with you, do we need to go send this back to the Court of Appeals to review the amount of restitution that the trial court ordered?
Your Honor, because the restitution order issued by the trial court was reviewable under an abuse of discretion standard, I would respectfully suggest that no, you would simply need to reverse the Court of Appeals and the order imposed by the trial court would stand. I don't believe that the
Did the Court of Appeals review whether it was the amount was an abuse of discretion?
The appellate court found that just the simple award of a lost wage, which they found to not be a direct and proximate result of the commission of the offense, was the abuse of discretion. The appellate court properly did not independently review the amount of the restitution because the appellate court would not be in a position to substitute its judgment for that of the trial court with regard to the amount.
Well, wasn't there a challenge to the amount of the restitution, too?
I believe that the appellant, Mr. Yerke, had questioned the evidence used to support the amount that was ordered.
Wouldn't the Court of Appeals have to assume we say that no, the state is correct, you are entitled to restitution for lost wages? Wouldn't the Court of Appeals still have to review whether the amount that was given was correct, whether the court abused its discretion, and some of the things that Justice Fisher was just talking about, for example?
The Court of Appeals didn't reach the second assignment of error that was raised because they made the finding on the first assignment of error as to the abuse of discretion. If this court were to determine that lost wages were compensable as restitution under Marcy's law and within the statutory framework set forth, the court should reverse the Court of Appeals. If you feel that second issue needs to be addressed, but it was not addressed by the Court of Appeals.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Mr. Rossi.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please this honorable court, Greg Rossi on behalf of the appellee John Yerke. And before I go into my argument, I'd like to address some of the questions that were raised by the judges themselves, the justices themselves. Chief Justice, you said this is about the commission of the offense, and that's exactly what the Seventh District Court of Appeals said. Restitution is dealing with the facts. What was the cause of the commission of the offense? And that's what you're looking at. What was directly and proximately caused by the commission of the offense, and the Court of Appeals correctly looked at commission versus prosecution because RC 29-2918 references as a result of the commission of the offense. So that's exactly what, and that's why we believe the Seventh District was correct.
The counselor says as a result.
Direct and proximate result of the commission of the offense, correct. Okay. And Justice Stewart, with respect to an issue you raised, and it's one of the reasons why I don't believe that the appellant's position should be adopted, is this is going to absolutely clog the trial courts. You're going to have a mechanism now where you're going to have trials on restitution, you're going to have evidentiary hearings on restitution, you're going to have appeals on restitution, and it's not what the clear statute set forth. So
Are there constitutional rights that we ignore because they would clog the trial courts?
So I'm not saying to ignore the constitutional right. The constitutional right for restitution, is that what you're referencing? Or
right.
Well, we're not ignoring it. We're asking that the statute.
If the Constitution orders a certain thing, how is that it would be difficult for trial courts to do
right.
an answer to that?
So the Constitution provides for full and timely restitution. RC 29-2918 provides for restitution. There's no conflict there. So therefore, you have to look at RC 29-2918. As part of my main argument, and I'm going to talk a lot about Marcy's law, but it doesn't define restitution. It doesn't provide a mechanism for restitution. It didn't expand restitution. Restitution was a right that victims had pursuant to statute for many, many years. So the constitutional right of restitution is incorporated in RC 29-2918, and there's no conflict between those two items. It says full restitution. There's a restitution statute. So in my opinion, the Seventh District was correct that this matter was decided by a clear and unambiguous statute. The statute was not superseded. There's no direct conflict. The statute was correctly applied by the Seventh District, as I just was mentioning, with respect to directly and proximately caused as a result of the commission of the offense.
Is Marcy's law self-executing?
It is self-executing, but it specifically says that it supersedes all laws that it conflicts with. And I'm respectfully submitting that there's no conflict because, number one, all Marcy's law says is full constitution or full restitution. It does not define restitution. So you have to look at the statute, which defines restitution, and there's no conflict there. There's no conflict between those respective provisions. The other argument I wanted, Justice Donnelly was asking about what other costs are included. And this is an absolute argument as well, and this is a slippery slope argument with respect to what's going to be claimed. Is it wages? Is it mileage? Is it daycare? Is it I need a new outfit? Is it I need to get my hair cut? What if I had moved away and I have to travel back? I mean, that's not as a result. That's the victim's choice, but that's their participation. They're not a party. This is also a rule of law argument. They're part of the process. It's the state versus the defendant. The victim is not a party to the action. They can appear, do not have to appear. They can voluntarily appear, or if they're subpoenaed, that's another situation. But it's part of the overall criminal process. It's a slippery slope argument. You allow for wages for participation or appearance, and what if you just appear and don't do anything? You're there, you're off of work, whatever it may be. There are certainly critical stages in the proceeding. Trial, obviously. Plea, perhaps. Sentencing, for sure. And so those are critical. The victim is going to be there for those, regardless if they're compensated for wages or not. Justice Fisher, you were asked if there were any cases, and I agree. The Shiflett case is different and distinguishable, and I don't agree with the Shiflett, and I put that in my brief. That was the alleged victim. They were minors, and their parents brought them to the court. I think that's distinguishable. However, I still disagree with the analysis of it. And interesting, the Belbacher case from the Seventh District, the victim asked for lost wages for appearing at the restitution hearing. And you know what the trial court judge said? No, you're not getting wages for coming to the restitution hearing when you're asking for restitution for the broken door that happened as a result of criminal damaging. Why also not to adopt the appellant's argument is restitution historically has been for, you have an injury, you know, what's the medical bill? You have, you write a bad check, what's the amount of the check? You commit insurance fraud, what amount did you receive? You know, those are readily verifiable and identifiable situation. You're going to have all kinds of proof issues as well. And Justice Fischer, you asked the question about what if she's on salary? Not only if she's on salary, what if, is it a full day? Is it a half a day? Is it a personal day? Is it a vacation day? How much time? Is it 1 hour? Is it 4 hours? Is it 8 hours? You know, the victim is obviously an important part of the process, but they're not a party. They may choose to participate. One thing about Marcy's Law, and historically, and the court did a great analysis in Centerville v. Knapp, is what's the purpose of Marcy's Law? Notice to the victims, opportunity to be present, and opportunity to be heard. All of which, I would argue, those rights existed under RC 2930.
Excuse me. Yes. Don't we think the purpose of Marcy's Law is the things that Marcy's Law says?
Sure.
Full compensation to the victim?
That
seems to be a purpose of the law, right?
It is one component. But if you look at the history behind Marcy's Law, it was really for notice and opportunity to be heard and opportunity to be present. Restitution was already part of the criminal code and a financial sanction available to a victim upon a request upon a trial court. Nothing was added. That is not a new right. In my opinion, Marcy's Law did not confer
I'm not sure that's true. Just to be fair, the law said previously the court may order restitution. Marcy's Law makes restitution mandatory, so it certainly it makes it a right where it didn't exist before.
Right, and it does say full, but does it define full? Does it define restitution? This court has also, in its analysis on NAB, looked to RC 2929-18 for guidance, didn't say, well, that statute no longer exists because it conflicts with Marcy's Law, and therefore we're going to interpret this analysis under Marcy's Law. This court still looked to RC 2929-18.
But in NAB, wasn't it the argument that the fire trucks and the ambulance and stuff like that, it wasn't where Centerville's building was blown up or something. That could be a different situation.
Right. They were doing their governmental function.
Right.
And basically the court said, you're not a victim, but really that's your function as the government anyway. That's what taxes
are
for. That's your job.
Right.
And therefore it's not going to be taxed. Interesting point, you know, you can award costs of prosecution, but that's specifically authorized by a statute, you know, in terms of certain costs. But this is not authorized by statute. Perhaps it's a legislative issue if that was going to be expanded. But RC 2929-18, when it deals with injury directly and proximately caused by the commission, defines economic loss to include lost wages, which were caused by the injury. It specifically says that. It doesn't say anything else about participation. So the language is clear and unambiguous in the statute. The statute needs to be applied, not rewritten or interpreted.
You're saying that the statute cannot be interpreted in light of a constitutional amendment?
No, I think they're consistent. I don't think they're in conflict with each other. And so since Marcy's Law doesn't define restitution, it says full restitution, you have a definition of restitution existing on the books that does not conflict. You apply the statutory language as part of the framework in determining restitution, and you arrive at a
decision. Well, the limiting phrase here is in direct and proximate result of the commission of the offense.
Correct.
And, you know, the restitution, whatever it is, if it can be linked to the commission of the offense, it'll be appropriate. However it's figured out, whether it's a half day salary, whether it's, whatever. But you're saying the prosecution of a offense is not part of the chain of events that take place because of a commission of the offense.
Correct. It's not a but-for analysis.
But isn't the analysis, I mean, whether or not it's foreseeable, proximate cause is foreseeable, right? Proximate cause depends on whether something is foreseeable as a result of an act. So the question is whether it's foreseeable that someone will be prosecuted as a result of a criminal offense. I mean, isn't that foreseeable?
But it says direct and proximate. So both of those. Direct means,
aren't those synonymous? A direct cause is a proximate cause?
I think it requires both, though. So
right, and usually a direct cause is a proximate cause of something, right? That those are.
Then it shouldn't say both words. It shouldn't say direct and proximate. It says direct and proximate versus indirect and proximate or just proximate cause. It says direct and proximate.
Why is it not direct? Why are you saying that direct doesn't apply?
Direct would be if the person was assaulted and they went to the hospital, that bill was incurred as a direct result of the assault. That's restitution. That's what restitution has historically been. An indirect would be down the road, not directly related, consequential, but not from the actual offense. And that's what the statute says, and that's what also the Seventh District Court of Appeals said, is restitution is for the acts which constituted the commission of the actual offense versus something that is remote or indirect or consequential. It's not a but-for analysis, and I don't think that's appropriate in the restitution context. If a charge is filed, there's going to be a sequence of events and hearings, whenever it may be. Those flow from a charge being filed. But what we're talking about is the victim's appearance or participation. They are there but for the fact that there was a charge, but going there is not from the criminal act, and that's what restitution is.
They are there but for the charge being filed, and the victim has a right under Marcy's law to attend, so it's foreseeable that there will be a trial. It's foreseeable she will attend. That seems the definition of direct and proximate cause.
But as a result of the commission of the offense,
that's
not prosecution, and that might be a legislative.
So are you saying a prosecution is not a direct consequence of a commission of offense?
No, it is a byproduct of that. It's a byproduct of the commission, but the language says commission. The language in the statute doesn't say prosecution. And what if, and I think Justice Stewart kind of raised an issue of this, what if the defendant is found not guilty? Is the victim liable for the defendant's wages or attorney's fees? The answer would be no, unless maybe malicious prosecution.
Is the victim liable for
right. On the flip side, if the defendant is found not guilty, but the defendant had to go to all these proceedings, is the victim in some way liable to the defendant?
Under what theory?
I'm saying they're not. They're not, unless there would be some type of tort. But in the absence of that, you're still participating in the process. So I'm just throwing it's the flip side argument as to why participation is not the end-all issue.
And for the analogy you just gave there, I guess if the victim wrongfully identifies the defender as a perpetrator, and the perpetrator has to go through trial to be acquitted, is the loss by the defendant in that case, could that those losses be passed on to a victim who wrongfully accused him of a crime?
Perhaps, but generally no. Okay. I think this ruling, if it was in the appellant's favor, could also promote a victim vindictiveness or punishment in a way by the victim not intended in ordinary other circumstances. And I think that's also a concern. But, the victim, unfortunately, is part of the process, but not a party, and normally to be subpoenaed. But they also have other mechanisms of participating. There's not a prosecutor who's not going to take a position or argue without in some way having a conference to some extent with the victim, even though the victim is not necessarily there.
That's not necessarily true. We hear from victims all the time that their rights their requests, their participation, what they want to see happened, or just to be in the line of communication, and that gives rise to Marcy's Law.
Right.
Because that wasn't the case in many, many instances.
Interesting about Marcy's Law is the notice provisions put the burden on the victim to be request for notice.
And understandably, because there may be some victims, given the nature of the crime, whatever it might be, psychologically, they want to distance themselves.
Right.
So you know, I don't think we can fault the victim because of the way Marcy's Law is written.
Right. So, but in terms of coming to every single stage, you know, are they going to be there every time? Do they have to be there every time? Are they choosing to be there every time? There are certain phases, obviously, in the criminal procedure.
Does it matter whether they're choosing to be there or whether they're subpoenaed to be there or whether, you know, the crime happened to them and this constitutional amendment allows for their attendance, a notification, and allows for them to deal with the consequences of the crime on their terms. And if they choose to attend and that results in economic loss to them, I think that's behind this whole concept.
Right. And I would simply argue that that's inconsistent with the restitution statute, and whether or not that's in conflict with Marcy's Law is a determination that this court has to make. I was mentioning about the chilling effect that was raised by the state, because if the victim is concerned about the financial impact of appearing at all those times, there are ways they can certainly communicate to limit or reduce that, and that would not eliminate their participation. There are plenty of opportunities for conference and participation. They don't have to be there at every single proceeding or stage, obviously the critical ones. But again, the statute is clear. I believe it's clear and unambiguous and does not provide for restitution to cover lost wages for mere participation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Counselor, you've used your time. You may take 30 seconds.
Thank you, Your Honors. Your Honors, just in conclusion, I would say to the court that victims have been thrust into the criminal justice system as a direct and proximate result of the defendant's conduct in the commission of the crime. And their ability to exercise their guaranteed constitutional rights under Marcy's Law to be present at the proceedings, to participate in those proceedings, and it's not up to the defendant to choose which ones they may or may not be present at. As we all know, criminal proceedings are fluid in nature. Many times issues come up at the course of perhaps a pretrial related to bond, etc., that a victim may choose to be there. It's not just at critical stages
counsel,
of those.
Counsel, can I ask a question?
I apologize.
You're not going to find a dispute up here that victims are very important part of the process. I think historically they've been neglected, and that's what was the impetus for Marcy's Law. But I'm trying to, we had a series of questions from my colleagues about what is a direct and proximate cause, or expenses directly and proximately caused, and where is the line? Where's the line? So a lot of victims require psychological counseling as a result of the crimes that were committed. Are the expenses related to that? Should they be included in restitution as well? Where do we draw the line?
Your Honor, the line that I would be asking this court to recognize is the right to full and timely restitution as guaranteed by Marcy's Law, and that full and timely restitution would be complete. And if an argument can be made and shown that counseling, et cetera, was a result of the harm, the economic harm suffered by the victim as because of this crime, then that should be part of the full and timely restitution. I know in this case there was a request for some counseling expenses to be reimbursed, but there was a finding by the trial court that those counseling bills were incurred prior to the commission of the offense. So they didn't find that direct and proximate causation. So that determination about direct and proximate as a result of the commission of the offense, I think, would go back to the trial court conducting the restitution hearing when the victim is exercising their right to make claim for full and timely restitution. Overall, I think that the appellee's argument here completely disregards Marcy's Law as a self-executing self-executing provision of constitutional law and simply wishes this court to say, well, Marcy's law is real nice, but we're just going to go back and look at the statute, and that's all we're going to do is utilize the statute to define and deal with the issues of restitution.
Thank you.
Thank you very much,
Your Honor. Take the matter under advisement, and you will be notified of our decision. Marshal, will you adjourn court, please?
All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session of the Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio now stands adjourned.